Welcome to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Today we'll find out about the Wounded Warrior Project's Soldier Ride 250.
I think sometimes, you know, we forget that there is still a lot of ability in veterans and wounded warriors in just in general. It's awesome to be able to kind of showcase those things and be a part of the Soldier Ride where others can see what our actual ability is.
New Jersey U.S. Senator Cory Booker chats with Newer Today host Michael Hill.
It's all Republicans voted against our bill to end partisan gerrymandering, and all Democrats voted to end this nightmare of partisan gerrymandering.
WBGO's John Kalish introduces us to 104-year-old psychologist Edmund Gordon.
Du Bois was my friend. He became my most consequential mentor.
And film critic Harlan Jacobson takes us to the Cannes Film Festival. All this coming up today on the WBGO Journal. Today we're talking about the Wounded Warrior Project Soldier Ride 250, which is underway and presented by NFL Salute to Service. The ride highlights veterans' courage, resilience, in a 1,000-mile cycling journey marking the country's anniversary. It will end on May 29th at the 9/11 Memorial in New York City. After serving 3 deployments as an Army medic, Kelly Elmlinger became a patient herself when cancer led to the amputation of her left leg. Rather than step away from the discipline and training that shaped her life, she began competing with a prosthetic and later represented Team USA in Paralympic triathlon. Kelly Elmlinger is one of 80 veterans participating in Wounded Warrior Project Soldier Ride 250. Some participants ride traditional bikes, while others are using hand cycles or recumbent bikes designed to accommodate their injuries. Together, the veterans are traveling from the WWP headquarters in Jacksonville, Florida, to Firehouse 10 next to the 9/11 Memorial in New York City. The route will feature historic landmarks reflecting 250 years of the nation's history, including a stop at Arlington National Cemetery. Today, we're joined by Kelly Elmlinger. Great to see you, Kelly, and thank you for your service.
Thank you.
We're also joined by Megan Wagner. Megan is the Director of Physical Health and Wellness for Wounded Warrior Project. She oversees programs that help veterans increase their physical activity and enhance their nutrition, mobility, and sleep. Megan is a Gold Star daughter from a military family and is married to an Army combat veteran who is a registered WWP warrior. Thanks for being here, Megan.
Thank you for having me.
Kelly, this ride is tied to America's 250th anniversary. What does participating in an event like this, marking the nation's independence and proud military history, mean to you as a veteran?
Participating in this year's Soldier Ride is incredibly special, and it's a time for me to reflect. I am able to reflect on my military service, and I think more specifically reflect on the men and women who didn't make it home. As a combat medic, that's something that I struggled with significantly, and that's how Wounded Warrior Project kind of helped with some acceptance of not being able to save everyone and bring everyone home. So on this ride, I'll be doing a lot of reflection, especially on those men and women that did make the ultimate sacrifice. And additionally, this is about ability. And as an amputee, I think sometimes, you know, we forget that there is still a lot of ability in veterans and wounded warriors in just in general. So to be able to be on this ride and have all sorts of bikes to accommodate the injuries and people's abilities, it's awesome to be able to kind of showcase those things and be a part of the Soldier Ride where others can see what our actual ability is.
It's going to take great stamina to do this ride in general, no matter what your situation is. How has Wounded Warrior Project helped you?
Wounded Warrior Project has definitely helped. I initially got started with adaptive sports because that's my comfort zone, being an athlete even since I was a kid. But how it specifically helped me for this Soldier Ride is, I would say, the mental health aspect. That's something that I did have some stigma with initially, as when I first entered the military and even through my deployments, mental health resources were not readily available the way they are now. So to be able to ask for help, receive the help, and then have Wounded Warrior Project kind of destigmatize that sense of, you know, mental health being a challenge and, you know, not make it so secret, that when you go on this ride, I think the mental aspect of, you know, doing that many hours on a bike for consecutive days, it's really kind of given an additional layer to, you know, mental health resiliency.
Megan, this is your specialty when it comes to physical activity with long-term physical and mental wellness for warriors in their years after military service. Obviously, extremely important, the work that you're doing.
Absolutely. Physical health and wellness is a big part of a service member's life. It's a part of the job. It creates structure and discipline and routine. And while in service, you're doing so with your unit, with your brothers and sisters at arms, and transitioning out of the military can create many challenges. Suddenly that structure is stripped away, and through Wounded Warrior Project programs and services, we're creating opportunities to connect back with other warriors, with other veterans, and through programs like Soldier Ride, which is an adaptive sports, adaptive cycling opportunity, along with many other opportunities, we are creating healing through movement. We believe that healing starts with movement. We encourage all modalities of movement. Physical activity is a lifestyle tool that can be familiar to veterans due to their service. However, we may need to help them restart that journey into health and wellness, and we may need to provide opportunities to introduce or reintroduce into sport, maybe through an adaptive option. So we're trying to encourage physical activity for veterans in the remaining parts of their life and through many different chapters of life and whatever obstacles they face, whether physical, but also, as Kelly mentioned, there can be mental and emotional and spiritual challenges as well. And physical activity can help with that. It can help reduce stress. It can help improve sleep and reduce pain. And these are incredible opportunities to connect with one another and feel support in that encouraging environment.
A grueling ride. Who came up with this wonderful idea?
So Soldier Ride is one of many programs and services that we routinely offer at Wounded Warrior Project, and we have done so for many years. These multi-day events happen throughout the nation, but this year, to commemorate America 250, we wanted to do something special, something unique. And so really to honor America's birthday, as well as recognize the service and sacrifice that military members have made, we came up with the idea to have 80 warriors ride from Jacksonville to New York City, as you mentioned. We have 80 warriors total, broken out into four different segments, 20 warriors within each segment. So each segment riding over 4 days, 250 miles total per segment. This is a way to put support into action. These warriors are showing up to connect with one another. They have different backgrounds and experiences. They're connecting with one another through the bonds of service, but we're also able to ride through these different communities to raise awareness for Wounded Warrior Project, for warriors that might be struggling or continue to need our services, or those that maybe have not asked for help yet, and provide that encouragement for them to do so. But also in riding through these communities, we're connecting with America. It really means a lot for community members to simply cheer people along. It really builds their resilience and pride, and that welcome home that they may or may not have received initially in leaving their service.
Kelly, you've won multiple medals at the World Championships, competed in multiple Paralympic Games, and member of the Team USA Triathlon. I understand your biggest motivator, though, is your daughter, Jaden. Tell us about her.
Yeah, so my daughter, Jaden, she's actually going to be turning 18 in a few months. She has been an incredible inspiration for me. When I was first diagnosed, she was roughly the age of 4. So she doesn't really know mom other than, you know, leg issues or no leg. So this is very accepting of her. She understands that, you know, there's significant challenges that, like, I've gone through. She's witnessed those. But I think for me is being able to show her that, like, I've not quit. I've not quit on her. I've not quit on me. And that's something that I'm incredibly proud of, because I just want her to be incredibly proud of me. I think she is. I hope she is. But she's also a teenager, so I don't know. But I do know that we have an amazing relationship, and I am so grateful for Wounded Warrior Project and the many organizations and other veterans that have encouraged me along the way so that I can still be an active part of her life.
She knows what an inspiration you are to others, doesn't she?
I'd like to tell you yes. But again, sometimes I don't get quite the honest answers. It's usually like, Mom.
I get it. Megan, how can we find out more information about this wonderful event?
To find out more information about Wounded Warrior Project or Soldier Ride 250, you can visit our website, woundedwarriorproject.org.
Once again, the Wounded Warrior Project Soldier Ride 250, presented by NFL Salute to Service, is underway. It started on May 14th and will end May 29th at Firehouse 10 next to the 9/11 Memorial in New York City. Kelly and Megan, thank you so much for everything you're doing and continued success.
Thank you.
Thank you.
New Jersey U.S. Senator and former Newark Mayor Cory Booker joined Michael Hill this week on our Newark Today program to talk about a number of issues.
We're talking here about the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act disappearing thanks to this Supreme Court ruling. What does taking the teeth out of Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act, what does this mean?
Well, it really means that we're going to be thrown back into an era of American history that so many people from diverse backgrounds unified to overcome. Remember, back after the Civil War, it was a time when the first blacks ever were elected to Congress. In states where black populations were 50%, we saw black senators and black congresspeople. But that period only lasted about 10 years when a reign of terror existed in the South and came in with the fall of Reconstruction, and you saw new poll taxes, voter suppression, and other tricks to eviscerate black representation in Congress. But then a movement over the next century came in which people sweat and struggled, were jailed for, and even killed, like Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner in Mississippi Burning, whether it's Fred Shuttlesworth stabbed and beaten, or even the great John Lewis and the marchers on the Edmund Pettus Bridge, who shocked the conscience of our country and eventually won the passage of the Voting Rights Act. And then again, you started seeing blacks starting to have fair representation. And for the first time, you started seeing blacks return from the South to Congress. And so what six people did on the Supreme Court by gutting Section 2 is they are allowing those very same states to now draw maps that again disappear black representation from those Southern states from Congress. States like Louisiana, where a third of the population is African American, Alabama and Mississippi, where 40% roughly are African American, will have no representation because of the way that Republicans will draw these maps to dilute their influence, dilute their voting rights, and effectively return us to a day and age in which African Americans really had no representation, no say in their federal federal government through Congress.
Senator, this retrenchment has caught the attention of a lot of people. I know, and you just mentioned Alabama and the South. You were in Alabama this month. What were you doing there, and what hope do you have that Alabama will be able to retain its black representation in Congress?
Well, just a few days ago, I was sitting with Terry Sewell, one of the two black congresspeople, an extraordinary woman who has led the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act in the House of Representatives, a bill that me and others picked up on the Senate side, and bills that would have banned partisan gerrymandering, in which, unfortunately, something that most Americans believe is unfair, that vote fell along party lines. All Republicans voted against our bill to end partisan gerrymandering, and all Democrats voted to end this nightmare of partisan gerrymandering. And I sat with Terry Sewell in conversation with over 1,000 Alabamians who showed up from Birmingham. I met a foot soldier that was on the Edmund Pettus Bridge and others who were there and know the legacy. That history hangs heavy in Birmingham, in Alabama. And there is fear and anger about what is going on, and they could possibly see their congresspeople disappear from Congress, but also a grit and a determination. They remember what the perseverance was in the past. They remember setbacks. They remember that Fred Shuttlesworth had his home bombed on Christmas and was the next day still out protesting on December 26th. And so I went down there to try to show folks that they're not alone in this fight, and that I'm going to do everything I can for my position in the Senate, my position on the Judiciary Committee, to find a way to end this partisan gerrymandering and preserve a fair democracy and fair election maps.
New Jersey U.S. Senator Cory Booker talking to Michael Hill on this week's Newark Today show. You can hear the entire show at wbgo.org/news. After World War II, a unique racially integrated community was built in Rockland County, New York, in the town of Pomona. Over the years, Skyview Acres has been home to several prominent political activists, as well as accomplished doctors and professors. WBGO's John Kalish introduces us to one of them, a 104-year-old psychologist who is still professionally active.
Edmund Gordon grew up in the 1920s and 30s. His family lived in the segregated town of Goldsboro, North Carolina, where blacks weren't permitted to shop alongside whites during the Jim Crow era. But because Gordon's father was a doctor, his family was allowed to shop in a department store on Wednesday afternoons.
I think my family's social economic position protected me from a lot of the worst aspects of segregation. I remember an encounter with the police when they were chasing me and some of my buddies off of a corner where we hung out, and we thought there was no reason for it except their dislike of us. But I don't remember a lot of other negative experiences.
Gordon was ordained as a Presbyterian minister and served a small congregation in Omaha, Nebraska, where he met Susan Gitt, an activist with a Quaker group. They married in 1948.
When I married Sue, I think that changed everything in my life, and I tend to attribute most of the good things that have happened to me to having been married to her. She insisted that I eat properly, insisted that I exercise. She gave me four lovely children.
Three of the Gordons' children pursued careers in education, including their son, Chris, a retired special ed teacher.
He didn't finish college until he was 39 years old, but he's the brightest kid I've got.
That's saying something, because two of the other Gordon kids have PhDs and are tenured university professors. Gordon himself has taught at several universities, including Columbia and Yale. The Institute for Urban and Minority Education at Columbia's Teachers College was renamed in Gordon's honor when he turned 100. His doctoral dissertation focused on child development in Harlem, where he and his pediatrician wife would later establish a clinic for children. While Gordon was in graduate school, he was befriended by W.E.B. Du Bois, the renowned African-American author and activist.
Du Bois was my friend, and more importantly, he became my most consequential mentor. It was through my meetings with Dr. Du Bois for supper, driving him to meetings, traveling with him, walking and talking with him in the park, that Du Bois taught me to think.
Gordon was working as a researcher at Stanford in 1964 when he was tapped by President Lyndon Johnson's domestic policy advisor to help develop Head Start, an early childhood education program. It was part of LBJ's War on Poverty.
The president wanted as many as 10,000 kids. By that June, when we opened the first Head Start program, that 10,000 kids had grown to 400,000.
Over the last 60 years, Head Start has touched the lives of more than 40 million children. But Gordon doesn't regard his work on the program as his most consequential. As far as he's concerned, his study of educational assessment is more important. And today, Gordon still participates in an online study group he started to grapple with the issue.
I like to brag about the fact that I've published about 400 technical articles and 30 books, four of them in 2025, I've got 3 underway.
That's 3 more books in progress. Edmund Gordon says the racist attitudes in American culture are now more deleterious than they were in his childhood. I asked him what he made of the scrapping of DEI initiatives around the country.
I'm particularly concerned right now because I have a son who built the program in Black Studies down in Texas. And they've just informed him that they're collapsing women's studies, Latina studies, Black studies, with a view to closing them out. The anti-diversity movement is primarily to contain the rise of colored people around the world. And I'm sure if I were Caucasian, I would be scared to death also.
Edmund Gordon's impact on education is apparent in a video produced in 2024 for his 102nd birthday. Among those who paid tribute to Gordon were several presidents of major universities. The video also included a message from Jeffrey Canada, the founder of Harlem Children's Zone, whose mission is to battle intergenerational poverty.
Your efforts have changed educational outcomes for poor children in this country, for children of color in this country, and you've set up a whole new group of pioneers. Your efforts have really shaped my thinking, my work, the work we do at the Harlem Children's Zone.
Today, Edmund Gordon uses a wheelchair for mobility, but he still manages to get into the indoor pool at his home to tread water 3 times a week. I ask Gordon if he thinks he'll ever retire. He says he hopes not.
I hope I die doing what I'm doing. I'm getting tired, but I don't think I know anything else to do. Certainly nothing else I should be doing.
Edmund Gordon, the educational psychologist, still professionally active at the age of 104. For the WBGO Journal, I'm John Kalish.
The 79th Cannes Film Festival comes to a close tonight with the awarding of the fabled Palme d'Or. Our film critic, Harlan Jacobson, is on the scene.
I'm coming to you from the Croisette, the seaside boulevard that ends at the Theatre Lumiere, where all of the competition films screen. And to date, the most fun I've had has actually been at the director's fortnight section of Cannes, where I took in Once Upon a Time in Harlem. From a trove of 16mm footage shot by the documentary black filmmaker, actor, and journalist William Greaves, of a gathering at Duke Ellington's in August 1972 of surviving members of the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s. The film is a 100-minute prism of black American artists and thinkers in the first third of the 20th century in the form of a house party. It platforms some of the brightest lights in Harlem past as they remember what they all did, where, when, and how, and still mix it up over everything. Are they Negro, black, or African-American? They sift it. They argue about Marcus Garvey's Pan-African versus mid-century civil rights movements. They vent about kids today, meaning 1972, who had no idea that anyone came before them in the struggle, or so they thought. It's a great project and walk up to black America, assembled and finished by William Greaves' son, David Greaves, in split screen back and forth, making the scene where UB Blake, who recalls playing cat houses when he was 14, and shuffle along collaborator Noble Sissel 3 years before he died. There's Ida Mae Cullen, widow of poet County Cullen, photographer James Vanderzee, who photographed Garvey, who died in 1940. They remember the ghosts, Zora Neale Hurston, Langston Hughes, Hubert Harrison, and Florence Mills, recalled by Blake as having great eyes that commanded the stage like nobody's business, and then adds, the rest you could throw away. Well, this is honest eavesdropping at its best. Here, David Greaves tells the Cannes audience after the screening about his own night with UB Blake.
I don't remember the party as such, but I remember the interviews more. But UB Blake, early on, I had picked him up at his home in Brooklyn to do the music, and took him to the music studio. And in the studio, there was this heavy rock band, and they were a metal band. And when UB walked in, hands over his ears. That, you know? And then they stopped. It's his turn to go on. So you be, so these guys, you know, guys long hair, you know, very with it in the 70s. And then, so you be walked across to the piano. I'm sorry. The tone in that room changed. They were just struck by him. And I remember it to this day. And you really had to be there to appreciate a change in tenor in these guys. Anyway, that was the most important time.
The pulse in most other quarters is definitely dark. Among the best of them is Fatherland by Pavel Pavlikovsky, a complex post-war portrait of German Nobel Prize-winning novelist Thomas Mann and his adult children, Erika and Klaus, in 1949, navigating Stalin, the unspeakable past, the intolerable moment that Pavlikovsky etches in silvery black and white, as he did in his previous Polish masterworks, Ida and Cold War. Hans Zischler as Mann, Sandra Hüller and August Diehl as his adult children, and every gorgeous frame made the first big splash in Cannes. At midpoint came Minotaur by Russian director Andrei Zviagintsev, taking the pulse of a wealthy oligarch, navigating a collapsing corporation, an unfaithful wife, the war swallowing the workforce at the start of Putin's war in Ukraine. Dmitry Mazurov sketches a very nearly sympathetic oligarch, half bull, half man, on collapsing ground in this thriller that lays out the terrain. Men who didn't make it to the Georgian border at the start of the war in Ukraine are at the bottom of a Russian economy where anything is doable by those at the top. Zviagintsev takes it from the personal to the zeitgeist. Money in Russia can buy off even the force of gravity. Witness the film's last sequence over Crete. You can read it or remake it as an echo of the West. It's the hardest kind of film to make, something close to the moment that has national vision, the way Coppola had in the 1970s. And it almost wasn't made at all. Zviagintsev nearly died from COVID, spent months unconscious, abandoned a film that was too controversial to finance in Russia, and instead here adapted Claude Chabrol's The Unfaithful Wife from 1969. To document Russia in its new form as a criminal state. You may have also heard that World War II is back with a vengeance at Cannes this year, really quite remarkably. And you have to assume it's because filmmakers used the rise of nationalism in the run-up to World War II in Europe as a lens on the intense polarization over the purity of citizenship now. The Free French resistance leader Jean Moulin, who acted to unite the quarreling resistance factions under de Gaulle, goes head-to-head with the Butcher of Lyon, Nazi Commandant Klaus Barbie, in Laszlo Nemes's film Moulin, in the competition for the Palme here. Emmanuel Mars' Our Salvation, in the competition, is about a mild but ambitious petty bureaucrat in the prefect labor department around the city of Limoges. Swan Arlot captures Henri Marr, a forebear of the filmmaker, as a modest man with almost no appetites or opinions, rather sweet in his way, who takes the smallest of pleasure in his modest career gains, which please his wife until she learns, for instance, that the nicely furnished apartment that came with the appointment used to belong to a Jewish family. If you're looking for star power, however, which the press has noted there is a lack of, there was star power in James Gray's Paper Tiger in competition, which returns Gray to the boroughs he knows best, Queens and Brooklyn. Adam Driver is an ex-cop turned developer. Miles Teller is his straight-shooting engineer brother, both navigating the Brighton Beach Russian mob. Scarlett Johansson channels Shelley Winters in her prime, practically, as the wife and mother kept in the dark about the black hole about to swallow the family. Again, not a good look for Russians here or there, but a great Gray film in New York color. And I'm Harlan Jacobson in Cannes for WBGO.
Thanks for listening to the WBGO Journal. I'm Doug Doyle. Join us next Saturday morning at 5:30 for another edition of the award-winning WBGO Journal. In the meantime, stay tuned to the world's greatest jazz and blues station, WBGO and WBGO.org.